There's a better world is to come and tell you why. There's a better world is to come and tell you why. We will feed 'em on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world is to come and tell you why. There's a better world is to come and don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world is to come and don't you see?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, Rick Spisak, news director of PNN, and with me tonight is Renee.
Hello, Rick.
Hello there, Renee. How are you?
I'm very fine.
She's associate producer of the show, always brings a fine level of talent, expertise, and intelligence to the show, and I know you welcome her just the way I do. I've got some news for you tonight, but before I get into the news, I do want to mention something that is on the lips of a lot of people out there. And I want to compare and contrast with you just for a second. The young life of Malala, the Pakistani girl who suffered a bullet to the head for trying to stand up for young people's rights. And the strange and terrible case of Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman. Let's think for just a second about these young people and the world that they're forced to make their way in. If we haven't done something to make this a more peaceful world, I think we're remiss. And with that, I will leave you to your own thoughts on those very terrible and powerful cases of justice. Okay, we've got some great guests tonight. We've got, in addition to the charming and talented Miss Renee Shaker, we've got Congressman Patrick Murphy of District 16 here in Florida. He's got a wonderful set of things to tell you about. He's successfully reached across the aisle and has got a bill in play, and he's also working very hard to get the funding necessary to help heal the Indian River Lagoon and the waterways around our dear Lake Okeechobee. And of course, you may know back in 2006, mind you, the Herbert Hoover Dam at the southern end of the lake was deemed one of the most dangerous structures in America in 2006. So he's trying to get some money to help that. We also have some very interesting, very talented commentators today. We've got Janelle Jones. She is a Muslim Democrat, and she's going to talk to us about her experience working for human rights and her religious liberty. Then we've got Ms. Paige Hooper-Reichbart, who is a tremendously wonderful person, who is a writer. She's a leader of an organization called, she's the director of Women in Revolution. And we'll ask her about that. And her comment is, it's about basic human rights, something that we all need. Then we've got a very talented woman named P.E. Nolan, who writes for a variety of online magazines, including the Menopausal Stoners and Worldwide Hippie. So it's she is a tremendous writer. And then we've got a Democratic activist from North Florida named Frank Day. And Frank is an amazing guy who's working very hard, a progressive up in the panhandle. And he is extraordinarily talented, very much called upon. He is the Walton County DEC Chair, District 1 Director of Small County Coalition, and also Congressional District 1 Chair. A tremendous guy who's going to talk to us about conditions in the panhandle. So now I've got some news. The Insider Threat Program, an initiative aimed at rooting out future leakers and other security violators, President Obama has ordered federal employees to report suspicious actions of their colleagues based on behavioral profiling techniques that are not scientifically proven yet to work, according to experts and government documents. The techniques are a key pillar in the Insider Threat Program, an unprecedented government-wide crackdown in which millions of federal bureaucrats and contractors must watch out for high-risk persons or behaviors among their coworkers. Eye shifts right, eye shifts left. Those who fail to report fail to report suspicious nature. I guess it depends on how suspicious you are. Those who fail to report could face penalties, including criminal charges. Obama mandated the program in October 2011. Executive order after Private Bradley Manning downloaded hundreds of thousands of documents from a classified computer network and gave them to WikiLeaks, the anti-secrecy group. The order covers virtually every federal department agency, including the Peace Corps, Department of Education, and others not directly involved in national security. Okay, next, I want to tell you a little bit about a story called, Hey, Computers Are Banned in Florida. They recently, after the disappointing showing of the woman who was the governor's lieutenant governor, that's right, lieutenant governor involved in internet gambling, they wrote a law basically making all internet gambling illegal in Florida. But we understand that the law was written so sketchily that it basically defines the ban was so hastily worded it can be applied to any computer or device connected to the internet. The ban defines illegal slot machines as any system or network of devices that may be used in a game of chance. So if you've ever played, you know, computer mumbly peg with your laptop, you may be violating the law. A quick rap to the knuckles will pretend you're a corporation. Black dust. Oh, boy. President of Boston Chemical Data Corporation and doctoral student researcher at Worcester Polytechnic reports that they kept hearing reports about something unusual, a black dust that was on the surface of soils or streets that was much more radioactive than any surrounding soil. This is in Fukushima. So it was almost as if some concentrated radioactive contaminant from the accident was pretty much refusing to disperse, collecting in small gullies or gutters, and folks were getting it. So we finally got a small sample. What's different about this material is, unlike a lot of the soil and dust samples they've gotten, there's a real uniformity to this stuff. It's a single substance. It's not a mix of mineral particles and pieces of dead bugs and plant matter, dust particles. It's actually very homogeneous and uniform when you look at it under the microscope, and it doesn't look like the surrounding soil. So it's much more intensely radioactive than any other soil or dust sample they've received from around Fukushima Daiichi. So this material is different. It's not natural soil. There's something unusual happening, and it's not just cesium that's there. We saw a good deal of radium. The sample had fairly high levels of radium-226, and that's not a radioisotope that we hear much about. Radium-226 is about as much activity as radioactive cesium in the sample. Radium-226 is a degraded product of uranium, and they really can't detect uranium directly. So this tells me that this particle contains not only fission waste material, but unburned nuclear fuel, and that's unusual. This sample had by far the greatest level of uranium daughters that they've ever seen in a dust or soil sample. They actually see materials that might have come from inside a failed fuel assembly. So when those things blow up, they must have just sprinkled down like black rain. Oh, boy, oh, boy. Arnie Gunderson of Fair Winds chief engineer said, okay, when I hear that, it's clear evidence that containment was breached. The interesting thing to me is that when I hear black, I think of algae or fungi or something like that. But you're saying this is not organic material. Is that right? Kaltoffen. No, it's not organic substance. It's a mixture of very small particles, and just the way an aggregate gives the appearance of being black, but it's probably, and I won't say an optical illusion, but it's the optical effect of the size of the particles and the way they're joined together. Are these particles light enough for people to ingest or breathe? Well, certainly they could be ingested. Right now, I would say that there's much more of an ingestion hazard. Average tends to target children and agricultural workers. A child, on average, consumes between 100 and 200 milligrams of soil a day because of hand-to-mouth activity. So that's something to think about. By the way, ladies, tampons and maxi pads were banned in the Texas legislature last week. Clearly, although concealed weapons are perfectly fine. Chevron was granted sweeping subpoena of critics' internet data. A federal judge has granted Chevron a broad and sweeping subpoena for data related to the $18.2 billion judgment against Chevron in Ecuador. The subpoena is trying to gain information on journalists and activists who may have been critical of Chevron. Critical of Chevron? Well, they want your data. After more than 8 months of silence, U.S. Circuit Court Judge Lewis Kaplan recently issued a long-awaited decision on the enforceability of a subpoena served by Microsoft on served by Chevron on Microsoft in connection with Chevron's lawsuit claiming it has been the victim of a conspiracy. Now, they conspired to poison Ecuador. In the $18.2 billion judgment against it for massive environmental contamination in Ecuador, but Kaplan's decision begs more questions than it answers. The sweeping subpoena was one of three issued to Google, Yahoo, and Microsoft demanding IP usage records, identity information for the holders of more than 100 email accounts, including environmental activists, journalists, and attorneys. The Chevron subpoena sought personal information about every account holder and IP address associated with every login to each account over a 9-year period. Hey, can you say overreach? The Electronic Freedom Foundation represented the account holders and fought the subpoenas in court in California and New York on First Amendment grounds, but to no avail. The judge was seemingly determined to see it Chevron's way. Kaplan's decision upheld Chevron's sweeping subpoena with an argument that is as breathtaking as the subpoena itself. According to Judge Chaplin, none of the account holders could benefit from First Amendment protection since the account holders had not shown they were U.S. citizens. Oh, wait. Let me break this down. The account holders, in this case, were proceeding anonymously from which the First Amendment permits. Because of this, Judge Chaplin was provided with no information about the account holder's residency or places of birth. It's somewhat amazing, then, that Kaplan assumed that the account holders were not U.S. citizens. And as far as I know, the judge has never made this assumption when presented with a First Amendment claim. We have to ask, then, on what basis did Judge Kaplan reach out and make this assumption? Well, there'll be more news ahead, but for now, let me turn it over to Ms. Renee Shaker.
So, Rick, does that mean if I send you an email complimenting you on the Chevron design you put in your latest piece of art, does that mean my email is going to get subpoenaed?
Oh, you know, there might be implied criticisms. One never knows. So let's just be safe and turn over all of your email.
All right. Well, for those who have been glued to the Trayvon Martin hearings this past week, it was probably easy to miss the farm bill that the House passed. And I call this the No Snap, Crackle, and Pop Farm Bill. For some time, many of us have had a sneaking suspicion, just a suspicion, mind you, that members of Congress might be more interested in serving themselves first, corporations second, and then maybe, just maybe, if all the stars are in the right alignment, and especially if there's an election coming up, then maybe the public. Well, for anyone who's had any doubt about this, the full bloom of self-dealing and hypocrisy were on full display this past week with the farm bill that the House passed. Now, for many years, there's been an uneasy but functional alliance between Republicans who support farm subsidies and Democrats who support nutritional support for poor and working Americans. You give me my farm subsidies, and I'll support your food stamp program, now called SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. But not anymore. Republicans in the House took the unprecedented and outrageous act of stripping out SNAP from the farm bill. Now, Tea Party conservatives have for a long time an all-purpose disdain for anything that smacks of redistribution of wealth, and food stamps have been a prime target. According to Republican Representative Stephen Fincher of Tennessee, quote, "The role of citizens, of Christians, of humanity is to take care of each other, but not for Washington to steal money from those in the country and give to others." But apparently they are just fine with stealing from taxpayers of this country to give to bloated welfare programs, as long as those welfare payments go to the well-heeled special interest, in this case, to the tune of $195 billion, which is going to go primarily to big agra. Republicans like to say they're for the little guy, the small business owners of America, but about a third of the farm subsidies in this bill go to the largest 4% of farm operators. If you want to see real welfare queens, look no further than Archer Daniel Midland's, Pilgrim's Pride, Tyler Farms, Riceland Foods, and the whole host of other big companies. As for those poor, struggling farmers, Well, their average household income last year was over $89,000, 25% higher than the average for all U.S. households. But here's the real kicker. Those welfare payments are especially okay if those well-heeled special interests are themselves. Yes, a lot of that money is going directly to those Republicans who voted for this farm bill. The good Christian Stephen Fincher and his good wife collected nearly $3.5 million in subsidies from 1999 to 2012 and stand to collect even more from this bill. Republican Doug LaMalfa of California and his good wife, Jill, together own one-third of DSL LaMalfa Family Partnership, which has collected over $5 million in subsidies since 1995. That would put LaMalfa's stake at a personal $1.7 million. And then there's Representative Mark Stutzman of Indiana, who's received nearly $200,000 in farm subsidies since 1997. All told, there are 15 members of Congress that got farm subsidies in 2012. Of those 15 members, 13 were Republicans. But even without this self-dealing, the farm deal was a bad deal. Scott Faber, Vice President of Government Affairs for the Environmental Working Group, posted a good piece on exactly what's wrong with this bill. Number one, it increases crop insurance subsidies. At a time of record farm income and record federal deficits, the House bill increases unlimited crop insurance subsidies by more than $9 billion and creates special insurance subsidies for both cotton and peanut farmers. Second, it raises price guarantees. The bill increases guarantees for major crops to lock in the current record prices and potentially puts taxpayers on the hook for billions of dollars in new outlays if prices fall. That income guarantee is 90%. Boy, I'd like to have somebody guarantee 95% of my income. It extends direct payments for cotton farmers. The House bill extends for nearly two more years the widely discredited direct payments for cotton farmers. Some of these guys, and yes, they're all guys, are getting more than $1 million in support. The bottom 80%, they get $5,000 on average. The bill makes new farm subsidies permanent. The bill would make these expanded subsidies, which would be the most costly farm subsidies in history, permanent law, even as it allows conservation and other critical programs to expire in 2018. It excludes crop insurance reform, failing to include common sense reforms that would subject crop insurance subsidies to payment limits, means tests, or other disclosure requirements. The bill also fails to include conservation compliance. It fails to include a provision, which was in the Senate's version of the bill, requiring farmers who receive insurance subsidies to adopt basic conservation practices. And it also cuts conservation programs. The House bill needlessly cut $5 billion from programs designed to reward farmers and ranchers who protect drinking water supplies or provide habitat for wildlife. These cuts come on top of recent cuts by the Appropriations Committee as a result of the sequester. It also blocks safety standards. The House bill prohibits states from setting their own farm and food standards, including provisions designed to keep food safe and promote animal welfare. And it also weakens environmental protections. The bill guts common sense rules that protect water and wildlife from contamination by agricultural pesticides. What's more, the bill eviscerates protections against environmental damage caused by logging, by short-circuiting environmental reviews, and limiting public involvement in critical areas. Moreover, while a favorite Republican pastime is bashing welfare queens, the amount of fraud in the agricultural crop insurance program would put any Cadillac-driving welfare queen to shame. Just last month, for example, Thomas Sasser, who for more than a decade as an insurance adjuster from Wilson, North Carolina, participated in a plot involving dozens of farmers, warehouse workers, and insurance agents who conspired to defraud the federal crop insurance program of nearly $100 million by making fake losses on crops. The New York Times reported, government audits and court records show hundreds of millions of dollars in losses due to fraud in a variety of farm programs, including crop insurance and subsidies that help agribusiness promote their products abroad. The rate of food stamp fraud, on the other hand, has declined sharply in recent years and now accounts for less than 1% of the program. The decision to strip away SNAP benefits was, of course, the work of the usual suspects, the Conservative Club for Growth, whose founding member, Stephen Moore, is a scholar at the American Legislative Exchange Council, Heritage Action, and the lobbying arm of the Heritage Foundation. In the meantime, SNAP, which serves the needs of 147 million Americans, remains in limbo. Minority Whip Steny Hoyer says that he has no confidence that Republicans will pass a SNAP bill this year. The farm bill now supposedly goes to conference to negotiate with Senate leaders over the bill that it passed last month, which includes $760 billion for food stamps and nutrition. But some are doubtful that any agreement can be made between the chambers without the SNAP assistance in the House bill. And House Republicans say they will stand firm and not negotiate a bill with SNAP in it. We can only hope then that a bill without SNAP will not likely have the votes to override a veto from President Obama. But hey, no worry, those poor congressmen, they got theirs.
Isn't that what's really important?
It's hypocrisy at its most outrageous, and the fact that they can all justify this as basically trying to rein in fraud in welfare and fraud in food stamps and other public assistance programs, when corporate fraud is much more rampant and infinitely more costly to our government than a few people who managed to scam some meager benefits.
Absolutely. It seems hard to believe that big ag would be taken care of first, and the neediest, the discomfited, would be cut off that way.
Well, it's just mind-blowing how they can rail against these programs on the basis of being against income redistribution and then turn around and do the same thing, only this time they're redistributing it into their own pockets.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let me go ahead and do another news story while we're waiting for the good congressman to connect in. There is a new massive uncontained leak at Fukushima, pouring over 710 billion becquerels of radioactive material into the atmosphere. The tsunami-caused nuclear accident at Fukushima power plant in Japan is a disaster that never ends. As new reports indicate that a wealth of new radioactive materials have been spewed into the atmosphere. According to Singapore-based news outlet Asia One, Tokyo Electric Power Company, which owns the multi-nuclear reactor power station at Fukushima, announced April 6th that some 120 tons of water has been contaminated and has been leaking. Running out of storage room, TEPCO officials announced that the leak late in April, but said measures to address the problem hadn't been undertaken because the cause had not been identified. According to company officials, TEPCO estimates that the leak water contained about 710 billion becquerels of radioactive substances. TEPCO began using the storage facility February 1, and as of April 5, 13,000 tons of radioactive water was being stored there, very close to the 14,000-ton limit. Asia One also reported that water samples taken from TEPCO from the soil surrounding the damaged facility showed that 35 becquerels per cubic centimeter of radioactivity, which is abnormal. Safe levels of becquerels is 300 per kilogram of water, as opposed to a cubic centimeter. TEPCO did not publicly announce the findings right away after not finding any other unusual changes. As sheets were joined when the facility was constructed, TEPCO assumed that the sheets have been damaged or the mistake had been made during construction. An average of about 400 tons a day of groundwater has seeped into the buildings housing the nuclear reactors and turbines. Okay, the disaster keeps on giving. TEPCO said earlier this month it expected the water transfer to take about 5 days. At the height of the water storage facility is relatively low. We think it's likely that the polluted water mixed with the underground water and reached the sea 800 meters away, said Masayuki Ono, the acting chief of TEPCO's nuclear facility. Also, this news on the 5th of July, radiation levels in Fukushima were what passes for normal, which means elevated and dangerous, but stable, according to the measurements by the owner Tokyo Electric Power. On July 8th, radiation levels had jumped about 90 times higher. On the 9th, the next day, radiation levels were up another 22%. TEPCO still had no explanation. On July 10th, let's see, that's just a couple days ago, Japan's Nuclear Regulatory Authority issued a statement saying that the NRA strongly suspects the radioactive water is coming from Fukushima reactor number 1 and is going into the Pacific. We must find the cause of this contamination and put the highest priority on implementing countermeasures, said NRA Chairman Sunishi Takawa. Okay, and let's see. Neither NRA nor TEPCO has determined why the radioactive levels have been increasing. Both characterize the increases as a spike, but so far this is a spike that hasn't come down. It just goes up. 10 becquerels per liter is the official safe measure. 60 becquerels per level for nuclear plants. The safety limit for drinking water is 60 becquerels. They have less concern, evidently, for the nuclear plant workers. 60 to 90 becquerels per liter is for wastewater nuclear power plants. They set a standard maximum of 90 becquerels per liter. Some of Fukushima's water monitoring wells, radiation levels were fractions of becquerel, and now they're 9,000 becquerels per liter. 11,000 becquerels per liter on July 9th, 18,000 becquerels of cesium on July 8th, 22,000 becquerels per liter of cesium-137 on July 9th. So nobody knows whether it will get worse or better. They just are trying to keep an eye on it. In an effort to prevent water from reaching the ocean, TEPCO is building what amounts to a huge underground dike. That's underground dike. A deeply sunken coastal containment wall. The NRA is calling TEPCO to finish the project before its scheduled 2015 completion date. Let's see here. This is an interesting story. Those of you who may have criticized Chevron. Let's see, we've already done part of that story. Let me go ahead and say it's a good time to make note of our fellow progressive activists out there. We've got Gwen Holden Berry, a wonderful show that is just before us here on Blog Talk. Her show is called Here Be Monsters. It's a wonderful mix of environmental and social issues. Brian Stetton, his show is on Friday nights and Monday nights. It's called Progress Toward Democracy. Look that up. It's a really good show. You should definitely check it out. Also, Anita Stewart has a show called Wise Woman Media. Susan Nylon has a show, The Nylon Report. It's on weekdays at 5 o'clock, I think, drive time, out of the Sarasota area. So look for The Nylon Report. Sita Bigui has a show called Sita Media. And Harriet Lerman has a show called The Voice of the People. All these progressive broadcasters are people you should be in touch with. You should be listening to their shows. They are excellent and certainly worth listening to. Okay, let's put on a little music for a moment and we'll be back with some more news.
They used to tell me I was building a dream. So I followed them all. When there was earth to plow, a gun to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream, with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line? Yeah. brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dollar? Once in khaki suits, gee, we looked swell. Full of that Yankee doodly down. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with the drum. Say, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al all the time. Why don't you remember? I'm your pal. Say, buddy, can you spare a dollar? Once in khaki suits, ah, gee, we looked swell. Full of that Yankee doodly down. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with a drum. Oh, say, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al all the time.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think we have the good congressman. Hello, sir. Welcome.
Hey. How you doing tonight?
Very good, sir. Very good. Boy, I'll tell you what. I've been catching you here and catching you there. I caught some C-SPAN footage of you talking up our Indian River Lagoon and the problems with the lake. Tell us, sir, what you've been working on lately. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, Congressman Patrick Murphy, sir. Welcome.
Thank you very much again for having me this evening. You know, the lagoon is one of the most important issues to everyone in this district, and one of the most important issues to myself, I think we can really have a good impact on. This is something that, I don't know if you saw the TC Palm today, but there were some letters in there that were written 40, 45 years ago, and they are still exactly true today. So these are problems that have been plaguing this area for a very long time, and what I'm trying to do is get the Corps, get the South Florida Water Management District, get the state, the local, and the federal government all on the same page, because everyone seems to be working in different directions and trying to come up with some sort of new ideas, because what we're doing now isn't working clearly. And looking at some new technologies, there's a lot of great ideas out there, some filtrations, there's a lot of other ideas out there that I think could make a real big difference in the Indian River Lagoon. And really the Everglades as a whole, and that's what's, I think, so important. You know, when it comes to the Everglades, there's a lot of projects out there, there's a lot of great ideas, but it's the comprehensive Everglades that's important. And something that might be happening to the north of us or to the south of us might actually really have an impact on this particular congressional district. So we have to look at it globally, in my opinion.
Well, sir, I absolutely have to salute you. It's so nice to see one of our civil servants out there actually working on behalf of making this a better environment, sir. It was so wonderful. I was transfixed watching you make that case. You know, that leads me to another thing. Most people, when they think of Congress, many people do not have the respect that Congress once held. There obviously is a degree of dysfunction up there. But I know you've made a real effort to reach out across the aisle. And why don't you talk to us about some of those agenda things you've been working on?
Yeah, well, you know, no question about it. I'm certainly frustrated with the gridlock and the partisanship in Congress. But, you know, I went there on a message of working across the aisle, because at the end of the day, whatever our principles are, and, you know, everyone has sort of a different approach, the only way it's going to get passed if it's bipartisan. And this is any issue, if it's health care, if it's immigration, if it's jobs, the economy, deficit, you know, the Indian River Lagoon. I mean, it's got to be bipartisan. So, you know, when you get to Congress, basically the first thing they do is you have several orientations, and they put the Democrats in one room, and they put the Republicans in another room, and they say, go figure it out. But we don't even get to know each other from day one. And that, to me, isn't a way to operate. So, started a bipartisan group called United Solutions and got together with a couple of the Republicans, and we sent a letter on to leadership, to Leader Pelosi, to Speaker Boehner, and President Obama, with three, you know, basic principles that this freshman group is trying to, you know, organize around. Number one, working together. You know, the whole idea that my way, the highway, doesn't work in your family, doesn't work in your business, certainly doesn't work in government. Number two is common sense solutions, and that we're going to need, you know, to really stop demagoguing. That this idea of, you know, pointing a finger, blaming President Obama, blaming President Bush or Clinton or Reagan doesn't get us anywhere. That we have to look beyond that. That we are where we are. Let's address the problems and move forward. And then number three was the focus to go big, to look at our fiscal house and to do what it takes to get our fiscal house in order. And, you know, that's something, you know, certainly that is tough for anybody to talk about, but I think it's the reality of where we're at and what voters really want right now. They're tired of the kicking the can down the road. They want real solutions, and they're tired of the partisanship. So that's what we've been focused on.
Oh, that's wonderful. Another question I want to ask you, and this one isn't an easy question, and I think it stems in part for me anyway from noticing that you're on the Environment and Energy Independence group. It's an issue that's important to you. We've got a situation where we have clearly an environment in South Florida that has had its stresses. It's certainly had its share of stresses. We have new fracking going on down in the southwest part of the state. And while it's not your district, the overall environment, and obviously there's an energy component of this kind of thinking. What do you know? What have you heard about the fracking issue? Obviously there's contending opinions out there, but clearly a lot of people have lost their water. Do you see this as an issue we need to be paying attention to here in Florida?
No question about it. To be honest, I don't know a lot about the fracking in Southwest Florida. I've, you know, studied it, fracking in other parts of the country, and we've had several hearings in Congress about it. And you know, we've had scientists from all over the country come in, and we've had business people. We've had, you know, all sort of walks of life, people that are for it and against it. And I've tried to develop, you know, my sort of own independent opinion of it after studying it. And there's no question that 40 years ago when this started, it was really, really bad for our environment. The chemicals that they were using, the technology that they were using, and then what they do afterwards with this dirty water, they dump it back into the ground, and it would seep right down into the water table, and that's completely unacceptable. But my understanding what they're doing now, it's come a long way. And it's not perfect, that's for sure. And I think there's an area that our government does need to get you know, a little bit more involved in, because there are certain chemicals that, quite frankly, we need to know about. And I think it's reasonable for these companies to tell us what they're using, and we can then take a look at it and analyze if that's, you know, what makes sense. And you know, some of the most recent technologies don't even use chemicals. It's purely fresh water, it's pressure, it's these beads that they're using, and they can extract everything they put down into the earth, they can pull back out. So when they leave, there's no remnants of it. Now, it does need to be studied because every environment is different, and every water table is at a different level. And there have been examples where the casing that they put down these you know, fracture lines has been breaking. The concrete, the steel casings have not been lasting for the intended life. And, you know, we can't mess with the water table. Water is going to be an issue. You know, most scientists would suggest that water be a bigger issue than fossil fuels in the next 40 to 50 years. So water is precious, and we need to protect it, and we need to make sure it's there for future generations. So I'm adamant about that, and that's why I think we need to ensure that, you know, these companies are disclosing what chemicals they're using, and that we continue to look at long-term effects of fracking. But not to ignore that we look at energy and all of the above lens. You know, energy is very important, and when you try to balance energy with job growth and with our economy, you know, there's been over 600,000 jobs in solely manufacturing come back to our country in the last 18 months. Most businesses that have done that solely attribute it to the low fuel cost, the low energy cost. A lot of that is because of natural gas, and you get to that because of fracking. So I think it's important that we try to find that balance there. And at the end of the day, natural gas isn't the ultimate solution. You know, we need to look toward renewables. But I believe this can serve as a bridge, and I believe it can get us there. But we need to continue investing in things like wind and thermal and tidal, solar, you name it. There's a lot of great ideas out there. We have to keep investing in it. And, you know, while we're talking about jobs, that's a great way to create jobs, is continue to invest in these renewable energy sources and create jobs here in our country and be the leader in that. Just like we're the leader in Facebook and the internet and you know, other sort of online, you know, outlets, we should be the leader in renewable energy and start, you know, being able to manufacture and sell that abroad.
Well, thank you, sir. I noticed that veterans' issues are important to you, and there was just a young man came home from service overseas here in the Treasure Coast area. I know veterans' issues are important to you. Do you see you see an increase in veteran services as we wind down the Afghanistan war?
Yes, no question about it. You know, we have three offices in the district, one in Palm Beach Gardens, one in downtown Stewart, and one in Port St. Lucie, and, you know, quite a few people helping out with constituent services. And the vast majority of what we deal with are veterans' issues. And in this area, we have a very large veteran population. Now, most of these veterans in this particular area are Vietnam, Korea, and World War II. But, of course, as, you know, Afghanistan is winding down, we are seeing more folks come home. And this is a top priority. You know, one of the big things we're working on is in November, we're going to have a Boots to Jobs conference. I've been lining up a lot of the employers locally, been lining up Workforce Solutions and a lot of the different outlets for these veterans that are coming home to ensure that they have a place to go work. You know, they're our heroes. They put their life on the line. At a minimum, we have to do everything in our power to ensure that they're employed when they come home. So certainly a top priority, but at the same time, a lot of the veterans that, you know, served, you know, decades ago are starting to reach an age where they need access to the VA, where some of their symptoms are starting to, you know, sort of come to light now, and we have to help them. And there is an unbelievable backlog at the VA that is completely unacceptable. I had a meeting with Jeff Miller, the chairman of the Veterans Affairs Committee, last week, and there were 12 members from Florida caucus engaged in that meeting. And we had the undersecretary of the Veterans Association there and got to really, you know, sort of drill her on what she's doing to improve this process. And it sounds like they're making some headway, but it's not quick enough, in my opinion. We've got to get this backlog down, and I think the wait time should be under 125 days at a minimum for these veterans to get the benefits they deserve.
Thank you so much, sir. One of the very difficult issues that's just gone through Congress is the Farm Bill. And I was wondering, sir, if you could give us your reflection on that process. I know bipartisanship is important. However, we see people, this historic bridge between big ag and food stamps or the SNAP program. Obviously, this there's been a breach there. Do you see this as a solvable problem or something that's going to really take a real concerted effort to get resolved?
That's a great question, and honestly, your guess is as good as mine, and I don't, you know, really want to speculate on it. You know, it passed the Senate, the Farm Bill passed, and, you know, what was coming out of the House wasn't, frankly, what I would have drafted up. It's not exactly what I wanted, but, you know, when I looked at it in the bigger picture and looked at what was happening locally for some of our local ag, you know, folks with the citrus, with some of the money that was granted for research and development here locally, with greening, and a lot of the ag folks I talked to, whether it was cattle, whether some of the specialty crops or citrus, they were all very, very supportive. So I try to take a balanced approach and a big picture view of it and voted for it the first time. I was, you know, one of about, I think, 20, 25 Democrats to support it. But then it didn't pass. And it didn't pass because, in the opinion of the Republicans, there wasn't enough cuts in there to the SNAP program, to the food stamp program. So what they did is they brought it back to the Congress, back to the House, and they removed 100% of the food stamp piece, the SNAP part of it, and there was another vote. Not a single Democrat voted for that farm bill without the SNAP program in it. And it passed the House, but it still didn't get to that 218 number. It passed with 216 votes, but they gaveled it down and called that a victory. Now, at the end of the day, that will, of course, not go anywhere in the Senate, and, of course, the president would never sign that bill. The House is right now claiming and suggesting to everybody that they're going to bring back the SNAP program separately, and that is going to be one of their focuses as they move forward. Your guess is as good as mine if they bring it up and what that's going to include, but certainly no Democrat supported the farm bill without any SNAP in it. So we'll see what happens. I certainly hope they bring it back. This is unacceptable that something like the farm bill has become so partisan that so many farmers, so many individuals are sort of in limbo right now, waiting for our government to get our act together, and it's pure partisanship. And what's going on with the farm bill is similar to what's going on with immigration and what's happening with health care, what's happening with a lot of issues. And it's partisanship getting in the way of real solutions. And it's the margins ruling the majority. And you have a small percentage of people that have what seems to be the loudest voice and this vocal group supporting them that are either intimidating or in some way or the other molding the legislation that's coming out of the House. And I think that's completely unacceptable.
Well, you have, I think, done a remarkable job in what is clearly a mixed population of Democrats and Republicans. You pulled off what some, I'm sure, would have called an unlikely victory. And I think that the progress you've made speaks so well for you. I almost hate to bring up the election idea, but I know you must feel a special pressure, not so much in the running for the office as to make sure that what you can accomplish in there is important for the local residents. Of the projects you've been working on this so far this year, what top two or three could you mention that you really feel are going to do something good for the community?
Sure. Well, let me start by saying I think you hit the nail on the head there, because my focus is really doing my job, and the better I am at doing my job in Congress, the better our chances are of re-election.
That does seem like the bottom line.
Right. So I don't need to focus on these campaign events and rallies. I need to focus on getting something done for the district. And I think at the end of the day, that's how we're going to be judged. If people decide to reelect me because we got something done and we're focused on the job at hand. Of course, there's parameters. This is Congress. It's a very polarized environment. But to the extent we can, trying to bring people together. And if I had to pick the sort of top, two or three issues, starting locally would be, the environment, would be the Everglades, really trying to work with all the different groups, and we kind of, touched on this already, but getting everyone together. Of course, funding is an issue there, but we've got to think outside the box. There are some very innovative people here locally and across the country that we're bringing into the table, we're bringing into the discussion to try to solve this problem. It shouldn't take, 20, 40 years to get this done. Some of the projects they're working on now I think are good, but this 10 to 15-year timetable is a very long time. So want to continue to focus there. Also, somewhat local but also a national issue is some of the regulations that have been put on some of the community and regional banks. Because of the financial collapse, there were a whole new set of rules that came out, namely Dodd-Frank. And while I support a lot of what happened there, a lot of it is having these unintended consequences that I actually think is going to have a really bad effect on sort of the little person out there, the little guy trying to make it, whether it's a small business or whether it's the first-time home buyer. A lot of folks my age even will really struggle to get that loan to start their new business or that loan to buy their first house, because the small community banks and regional banks simply don't want to be in the business of loaning, especially mortgages, to first-time home buyers because they don't meet some of the qualifications called, QM and QRN. And that's unfortunate, because if you're a small business and if you're an entrepreneur, the way you get your start isn't going to J.P. Morgan or Wells Fargo. It's by going to your community bank, going to the Seacoast or one of the local banks, and you have a relationship with the people there, and they help you out. And when they get out of that business, what's going to happen is the big banks are going to get bigger. And that's something that I think we need to be very careful of, because that's what we saw was a problem in this, this collapse in 2007, 2008. We had these banks that were a systemic risk to our economy. And right now, they're about to get bigger. They're sort of gobbling up a lot of the little, you know, branches out there. And that isn't healthy, in my opinion. I think, you know, part of what makes America so great is access to capital, that you have so many different varieties of you know, getting this capital. And we're starting to put a stranglehold on that. So that is something that's happening at the national level, but we'll really have local effects if we're not careful with it. And, you know, I just want to, you know, of course, be careful here to say that there are some regulations in Dodd-Frank that are very important to prevent, you know, this collapse from happening again. But that idea of one size fits all with regulation does not work. There's a lot of, you know, small banks here that are going to be held to regulations and standards that they simply, you know, shouldn't be. And they're not in the business that, you know, the Wells Fargo are with the derivatives and a lot of the big trades that they were making that they don't, you know, participate in. So it's important that we get that right. Also, you know, that kind of ties into to the housing market. And, you know, housing is a critical part of our economy. And the, you know, the middle class of our country, in large part, is, you know, wants to spend money when they feel secure about their biggest asset. Their biggest asset is their home, typically. So we have to make sure we have a stable housing market. And we have to make sure that Fannie, Freddie are right-sized. Not, you know, a lot of people want to get rid of them. We have to make sure they're right-sized. And if we do a good job with that, we can make sure that the 30-year, you know, mortgage continues to exist for years to come. And that will only strengthen our middle class and ensure people continue to have faith in our economy and continue to, you know, buy that next TV, buy that next car, make that purchase, which keeps our economy going.
Thank you so much. One of the issues we haven't gotten to yet, and I know is very important to our audience, many, many Americans have been literally shocked by some of the legislation across the country on women's issues, access to birth control, access to clinics. We haven't seen the worst of it worst enacted here in Florida, but I'm sure the spectacle of what's been happening in Texas isn't lost on anyone in national life. What's your reaction to some of this, and how can we make sure that women in Florida don't have to suffer these incredible indignities?
You know, it's there's no question that, I know it's going to sound cliche, but it's happening across the country. There's an all-out war on women. It happened in the 2012 elections, and it's happening again now. You would have thought, at least I would have thought, that you know, people would have learned from this, and you know, some of the comments that were made throughout that last election, it's happening again, and now they're putting it into law. And that's what just happened in Texas. They're looking at it in North Carolina, and they're trying to do it in Florida. So at the end of the day, it's up to the voters. If, you know, people aren't happy, they've got to show up to vote. And this is what's scary about the 2014 elections. The midterm elections traditionally don't have great turnout. And, you know, a lot of, you know, my colleagues on the other side of the aisle are sort of banking on this. And whether it's immigration, whether it's women's issues, whether it's, you know, equality issues, they're banking on the Democratic base not showing up in 2014. So this is a critical election. We've got to make sure we hold the Senate, got to do everything we can to try to get the House back. And really, we've got to look at the state and local level, because a lot of these rules that are coming out, especially as you relate to women, which your question was, are coming at the state level. And we have to do a better job of turning out the vote. And in doing so, we've got to do a better job of looking at redistricting and fighting that battle. You know, I think one of the biggest problems in politics isn't just the money, and we all talk about that a lot, but it's the gerrymandering of districts. 82% of congressional districts are predetermined, whether it's going to be a Democrat or a Republican. Therefore, there's no general election, and therefore there's no incentive to ever get to the middle to make a deal. So a lot of members of Congress, and this has the same thing at the state level, are simply fighting for their primary. And that pushes them to the extreme and doesn't allow them to ever come to the middle to compromise, because that will never help them get reelected. So we've got to look at the gerrymandering. I think that's a big issue in our country that led to this polarization.
Well, sir, let me ask you one final question, if I may. You know, for a couple decades now, there's the phrase the baby boomers has been on the lips of everyone who thinks about numbers and thinks about populations and demographics. Now we're coming to what's going to be the end of the baby boomers. The last, the next 20, 30 years, we'll see the end of that little bump in the demographic. As the baby boomers age, obviously there's going to be a bigger demand on senior resources, issues, and whether it be health care or medical care or residential care. How do you think we're preparing for that tail end of the baby boomer bump?
Well, we're not doing enough, that's for sure. When you go through our budget and you look sort of line by line at what has happened, what's got us to the position we're in now, and what the future holds, the single biggest issue is healthcare and the really unsustainable rise in healthcare costs, which has been going up for the last 40 years at about 12%, 12 to 15%. That's unsustainable. We've got to address this. You know, people talk about all sorts of other issues in our government. If we can get this one under control, we can get our budget control. And just to put it in perspective, the last 2 years, healthcare costs nationwide have risen at about 3.8-3.9% for the last 2 years. This is historic. This is the first time that we've sort of bent that curve in, as I said, 42 years. We've sort of bent the curve. If we can maintain healthcare costs rising at that level, that 3.8-3.9% rate, our long-term debt of about $17 trillion basically disappears. We basically get rid of it because that debt is based on projections of healthcare rising at around 12 to 15%. So we've got to put more focus there, got to do everything we can, whether that's technology, whether that's, looking at ways to improve the Affordable Care Act to put a cap on these healthcare costs. So that's a big aspect of it. And, as the baby boomers start to age, there's going to be, other issues that I think are going to come up and we're certainly starting to see it in my district. A lot of that is senior care, is nursing home, is in-home care, and a lot of the issues that accompany that, we hear that constantly in our field office. So but we need to do a better job preparing. And, as the baby boomers age, this brings up a lot of other issues, such as immigration reform and as I said, healthcare, which we've got to do a better job at.
Well, let me leave you one final comment to make, sir. What are Democrats going to do to get those voters out there, sir?
To me, it's connecting dots and showing how important it is to vote in this election and what happens when you don't vote and some of the laws that get passed. In 2010 in Florida, we ended up with Governor Rick Scott. And with a supermajority Republican, House and Senate, and a Republican governor, and what's one of the first things they did was voter suppression. They changed the rules there. They started going after a lot of our rights that we've been fighting for many years. So we have to, and this is something I tell my peers constantly, and a big part of why I got involved in government in the first place was a lot of what's being decided right now at all levels of government is going to affect our generation. A lot of people our age are going to be affected. So we've got to get involved in politics. We've got to, as politicians, I think, help connect the dots and explain to people how a certain piece of legislation, how a bill with maybe a fancy name like Dodd-Frank may actually really affect them. That may prevent them from being able to buy their first house or make it take that much longer to get it. So, unfortunately, money does help get the word out there. That's an unfortunate part of politics. That's, something we can save for, another interview on what I'm trying to do to get the money out of politics. But, as of now, it is there. So people are going to, have to stay awake and be alert and understand that you can't just wait every 4 years to vote. That you got to get out there every 2 years. It's a critical election, and our future, is dependent on it.
Thank you so much, Congressman. We really appreciate your time as Congressman Patrick Murphy serving the 18th District of Florida. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Okay, thanks
All right.
so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I think we've got our next guest, Miss Janelle Jones. Janelle, welcome.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. You're sounding nice and clear. Thank you so much for coming.
I'm so happy to. I remember back way, I met you way back in the Allen West town hall days.
Sure, sure.
We all remember those town halls, don't we?
Yes, indeed.
Well, I mean, basically, I got involved through YouTube videos. I saw him attacking CARE, and I got angry about it, you know, and that's how I really got involved with politics. I got involved because of hate groups that have been developing through the Tea Party in the last 3 years in our county, in Wellington, out in, you know, in Broward County. I mean, Joe Kaufman, we have Tom Trento out there harassing the kids from FAU, harassing speakers at FAU. You know, I took it upon myself to say, you know what, no one's doing anything about this, and this is wrong. We don't need to have these people going and harassing people because of freedom of speech. You know, no matter what anyone's opinion is, you don't have any right to go and harass them and put them on YouTube. And, you know, these are people that I personally know, and it offended me so much that I had to get involved. And for me personally, during the election, I didn't wear a hijab, and I didn't want to be attacked by the Tea Party because I know that's what they're going to do. And, you know, I personally just really got angry. I was really mad about Allen West. He came up to me several times and called me a liberal groupie with me and Patricia at a town hall back in April 2011. After
that,
it was on. Yeah, Tom Trento was there even. I hadn't had the chance to meet him yet, but, yeah, I was there for all those town halls. He came up and said, he's called me several names to my face, and I said to him, you remember those days, but I mean, I was actually flipping through those YouTube videos a couple days ago, and I was like, my God, look at all this garbage.
But now,
as the election has gotten over and, you know, things sort of went back to normal, I got Tom Trento's emails on my email list, and I just started seeing more and more and more radical stuff. And I said, okay, you're saying radical, crazy things, alrighty. And then I got another email that just got me so upset and so offended that I decided, you know what, this is it. I'm done. I'm going to go to FAU. I'm going to get my friend Muhammad, and I asked him, I said, hey, listen, you know, maybe we should get a coalition together and we should try to stop this and have a collective Muslim voice to say, hey, listen, guy, this is not okay. What you're doing is not okay. You're going around harassing people. You're going around. I mean, he's hysterical. I mean, he makes up statistics. He goes around and using Fox, you know, news points that are totally, completely false. First of all, in the Quran, you cannot translate because there's no certain English words for the Quran. So he's taking total verses out of context, just like Allen West did also. And I said, sir, you are completely wrong. You have no idea what you're talking about. Have you ever talked to a scholar who's in the Islamic faith? And I mean, you know, it goes round and round and round. And basically, he goes around and scares people, okay? And then he gets people, it's a complete hate group. I mean, he's going to Southern Poverty Law Center as a hate group. And Joe Kaufman's been going after FAU professor that's Syrian that has nothing to do with anything. He makes up things that are so ridiculous. I mean, if you go on his website and stuff, it's laughable. It's really laughable. But besides that, I just wanted to sort of introduce myself to people. Like, she's like, who is this person talking on the radio? My name is Chanel Jones. I'm from the DEC of Palm Beach County. I'm one of the only Muslim women in Palm Beach County as a DEC member. I was on the ADC and decided to leave because of political differences within that organization in South Florida. I was reporting hate groups and online hate groups to the Southern Poverty Law Center. I basically have been monitoring these hate groups for the past two or three years now. thing that has been getting me very, very, very concerned, and that should Democratic progressives should be concerned about, is that the Tea Party sort of has gone underground a little bit. They're getting a lot more radical. Their rhetoric is getting more radical. I'm very afraid of, you know, things that have happened in other states like Tennessee where there's been mosque, you know, vandalism and, you know, these things, you know, sort of terrorizing Muslims, you know. It's just
I could never quite understand why people who thought of themselves as patriots somehow missed freedom of speech and freedom of religion in the Bill of Rights.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, their freedom of religion is only, I mean, forgive me, because I love my Christians, I love my Jews, I love everybody, you know. They feel like the only reason that, when they say freedom of religion, they feel like freedom of religion is only for evangelistic Christians. They don't feel like freedom of religion is for Hindus, for, you know, Muslims, for any other faith but their own. And for us campaign people, like, I was in the nitty-gritty for that. I mean, I pulled my legs campaigning, okay? This campaign was, I mean, I honest to God, I went to go stand up one morning. I was like, oh, dear God, my legs have fallen. They don't work anymore. So I was just walking and walking and walking and campaigning, knock, knock on the door. And I tried my very, very best to get out there and get that vote out there because I knew this election was tremendously important. It was about Al West getting out of office, and it was about Obama getting into office. And we were on the forefront fighting that battle against those Tea Partiers when the presidential debate was going on in Boca Raton. People were pushing me, spitting on me, calling me every name in the book, saying horrific things about abortion to my face. These people came out of the woodworks of Loxahatchee or wherever they come from, these Tea Party people. And they were out to the vote. And, I mean, police officers had to remove them from me because they were going to hurt me. And I actually went over there as a Muslim. I wasn't wearing my hijab at the time. They had rabbis holding signs, and these Tea Party people were going to attack them. They ripped up the signs. They were calling them every curse word you can think of. And these are holy men from the book of God, you know. And I said, you guys, I went over there, and I, as a Muslim, and protected these rabbis. I said, you people, I'm 110 pounds, and I got in their face, and I said, you're not going to touch me. And, you know, it was just a rough time during the election. I'm so happy it's over and we got our Democratic elected officials in there. I'm so
yep.
proud. Every time I see them at a DEC meeting, I feel so tremendously proud of all the hard work we did because it truly paid off.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people just assume with all the big money behind West, no matter who we put up against him, he was a shoo-in. There was no question. And yet we see what people power can do. It's obviously, what democracy is really all about. I was wondering if you could...
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I know, you know, you've been very heavily involved in organizing Democrats. Are you working in the college arena these days?
You know, what's funny about that is that I actually I was working for a while, and then after the election ended, I was sort of like, well, what do I do now? I think that's what everyone felt for a couple of weeks. They're like, well, what do I do? Like, I got the calling people stopped, the knocking stopped. Everything sort of just stopped, and just sort of were like, well, what do I do now? I've been doing this for like 18 hours a day, and then it sort of stopped. So I actually have friends at FAU, and I organize with them a lot. And I'm going to Palm Beach State College right now to do criminology. From my own, you know, how I really got involved with is that I used to, as a child, I mean, I lived in Lake Worth, you know. I didn't live out in Wellington or Boca or anything like that. So my little home safe place was in the library, you know. I went to the library and I just started reading massive books, book after book after book. And I think today is one of the hardest days to really do an interview. And, I mean, it sort of shook my soul a little bit last night when I heard around 10:30 that not guilty. You know, I think it sort of shook. I think a lot of people were probably not surprised because they had that trial in Stanford. And I was hoping for at least manslaughter. I remember going past, I was in the library today, actually, and I remember going past the books in the African-American Civil Rights Movement, the NAACP books, the Movement of the Civil Rights. And it almost made me cry a little bit because, if they're doing this, they could kill me, you know. They see me with a hijab on. Maybe I'm a terrorist. Maybe they want to kill me. Maybe I'm a threat to somebody, you know. I think it made us sort of think, what's really going on? You know, we have the Bradley Manley, trial going on. No one's talking about it.
Yeah.
I don't think people really understand the tremendous things that are happening in American history as of this weekend and this month. I don't think people understand the magnification of what's going on.
Well, luckily, they have people like you to help remind them of the importance of the democratic process. I think you're an excellent exemplar of somebody who said, I'm not happy with what's going on. What's going on is terrible. I'm going to work on changing it. And you were there. You stood up to that kind of ignorant bigotry.
Yeah.
And I salute you.
Yeah.
I really do.
Yeah, and I had people yelling, this little 110-pound girl that I am, people yelling at me, cursing at me. I said, guys, you know what? I'm sorry that you feel that way. I'm sorry. I feel bad for them because they're so ignorant. Go read. I told Alan West, go read. Go get some real statistics that are real.
Well, Janelle, thank you so much.
Your social security is going bankrupt. Oh, really? Go read a book, please. I mean, come on. Social security is the most solvent, programs in our government. And I'm like, give me a break. And all his rhetoric and scare tactics didn't work. And you know what? Patrick Murphy's, back there chilling, doing interviews and in the Congress, doing stuff. I'm so proud of him and, Dave Koerner. I think Dave Koerner, I saw that guy. I saw Dave Koerner, and I was like, my God, that guy's never getting elected. I think a lot of us Democrats, I'm like, that guy is, like, short, skinny, and 28 years old. He's never going to get elected. And I saw Dave Koerner the other day at the Young Democrats meeting, and he's elected and doing wonderful things. I mean, he's gotten so many bills to be passed, and he's moving and grooving up there, and I love it. I'm so proud of him.
Thank you.
Thanks again, Janelle.
Thanks again.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'd love to have you back again sometime, okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime at all. And I thank you so much for all your activism and all your getting out the word to people through your radio show. And I really appreciate everything you did and you're doing.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much.
Thank
okay,
you.
Have a good night. Bye-bye.
All right, you too. Bye.
Bye. Okay, now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for a word from our sponsor, Legal Shield.
What is Legal Shield? It's total access. It's total freedom. Everyone deserves legal protection. And now, with Legal Shield, everyone can access it. No matter how traumatic, no matter how trivial, whatever your situation is, we are there to help. From real estate to divorce advice, identity theft, and beyond. Legal Shield has your rights covered. With Legal Shield, you'll be able to talk to a dedicated, experienced attorney about whatever you want, as often as you want, for less than $20 a month, no matter what happens. Legal Shield will have you protected and empowered to worry less and live more. Please visit www.mrsdd.com. That's www.mrsdd.com. Legal Shield.
And there we go, Legal Shield. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Ms. Paige Hooper-Reichbart, who was the director, or is the director, of Women in Revolution, an extraordinary essayist, a great wit. Welcome, Paige. How are you tonight?
Well, I'm fine and flattered, Richard.
Well, I've enjoyed your writing for some time, and I thought it was about darn time you got on the show.
Oh, well, I'm delighted to be here.
Paige, let me ask you this. You know, the demands of our life nowadays is so extraordinary. Where you used to have one breadwinner be able to call in and one breadwinner be able to raise a family while the other one stayed at home in the best situation, I guess. Nowadays, both homemakers have to work. People are working two and three jobs. In this kind of crazy world, you have made time, like so many other good people, to make a difference, to contribute. Paige, what was it that made you step up?
It was a long time ago that I was first active, both in the peace movement and in early women's liberation. And then I had other family commitments for a long time.
Sure.
And then suddenly, maybe it was the stage in my life where I could come back to it, where I am still a full-time caretaker for two disabled children. But it enables me throughout the day to keep the laptop open, keep the phone open. And I really got interested because of two photographers. One was Jenna Pope, who many people know as an activist who came out of the Midwest and then into Occupy. Did a lot with Occupy Sandy. The last time I saw pictures, they were from Turkey, and now I know she's back. But just following the images that she was putting out, the stories she was telling, the truth she was trying to present, and another young photographer from Syria who was a school teacher who, when the war broke out, tried to document what she could on a cell phone, and a photographer from one of the major media outlets saw her doing this, saw her pictures, stayed a couple extra days, gave her some of his camera equipment, and she's now running a media center in Aleppo. And again, it was that here I am, this is the truth, I want people to know what it is, see what's going on, make their judgments, and that really totally captured me.
Yes, unfortunately, those of us who spend a little time in the peace work have been kept busy over the last few decades. I saw an old friend who I met way back a few weeks when we were protesting the Vietnam War, and I see him, I guess, every couple years, and I just happened to see him a month or two back, and this is just as we're being told that we'll be helping out one set of fanatics against another set of fanatics in Syria. And, of course, that
right.
always works out so well. And I said, so, Dave, I see we have a new war to protest. And he looked at me for a second, and because we were in a political environment about to hear some political speeches. And it just struck him. It struck him, and you could see it was a visceral reaction. He just fell against the wall, and he goes, man, we've got to stop meeting like this. This is terrible.
Exactly. You do see new themes, but mostly old themes. But it's exciting to see these young women doing it. And it's exciting at the same time as I get caught up in this and online more and more with seeing various groups and various people, more and more people my age in their 60s coming back saying, you need what, where, you know, I'll be there, or I'll do whatever.
I'll tell you, one thing I have to admit, I never imagined that the fight for women's rights would have so many repeats in it. I really thought we'd come a little bit further than that.
I'm not sure I had that confidence. But I did think that some of the reproductive rights were settled for now, and of course they're not. And I think that's just come back because there is a continuing struggle of control, and women are going to take the brunt of that.
Well, you know, I used to say to several of my women friends, you know, we need to make time for the economic fight, too. You know, I mean, I can't believe we're still fighting for access to birth control. I can't believe we're still fighting for access to clinics. And we just never seem to get to the economic discussion. And frankly, you know, I may be a man, but I had a wonderful mother, a wonderful grandmother. I have a wonderful wife. I've had two wonderful daughters. You know, I'm pro-human. And why aren't we making
right.
that battle?
Okay.
Yes, go ahead. Are you still there? Maybe we're having some audio difficulty. I hear sounds coming from you, Paige. I'll tell you what. I'm going to go ahead and bring P.E. in. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce Miss P.E. Nolan. P.E., welcome.
Hello, and do call me Tricia. Everybody
Tricia.
Does. Yeah, much easier than Pat.
Okie dokie. Okie dokie, Tricia. So I understand you just – well, first, let's say that Tricia is an essayist, an activist. She's one of the founders of Menopausal Stoner. She also writes for Hippie World News.
I write for – it's a Worldwide Hippies news and stuff. I have a segment on the news, which is video. I'm a contributing writer at Worldwide Hippies, which is a website, just www.worldwidehippies.com. And, of course, Roundtree 7, which is how you and I found each other, I think, through our common friend Gwendolyn Holden.
Indeed, indeed.
At Here Be Monsters.
Well, you know what? Paige just showed up. Let me bring her back.
Okay.
Let her talk for a couple more minutes, and then we'll bring you in full time, okay? Okay,
sounds
hold on
great.
One sec. Thank you, dear. Paige, welcome back.
I'm sorry about that. Don't know where
oh,
I went.
Oh, that's okay. Listen, you know, technology sometimes our friend, sometimes our helpmate. So I was asking you, why do you think we keep having to fight these battles for women's rights? Why have we not gotten to the equity of pay yet?
I don't know that it could happen soon. When you look historically on how long women have had to struggle for their rights, I don't know that it could happen faster. I think as long as there... All right,
Let me tell you a short story, and maybe you can react to that. I relocated from one part of Florida to another back in 2004, in time for the political shenanigans. And as I moved up here, I took on a position as operations manager of a TV station, and of course, as a operations manager and senior producer, I produced the public affairs part, which is my favorite part of television, certainly commercial television. But anyway, there was a women's clinic firebombed in Palm Beach. And I said to my colleagues on the board of Planned Parenthood, I said, you know, we need to make this a serious issue. This can't be swept under the rug. This can't be left for this, often the haphazards of the police work that doesn't really investigate crimes they don't really want to solve. And I said, you know, we need to really make a stand. And they pulled back and said, no, we're going to try to do this behind the scenes and correct things that way. And they did. And I know if I tried to host a show on the abortion clinic that was firebombed, there's no way I could get that through the station. So what I did was I called it a women's health show, and I invited several different healthcare providers, including Planned Parenthood, and was able to do it that way. We all just saw what was going on in Texas. This, pass out your hand in your tampons and pads, but we can let the concealed weapons go. I find it absolutely amazing that this kind of thinking can be still in the civic arena.
I really think until we get more women into elected office, more women voting, that it's not going to change. And I think the key of that is getting the women to vote. And I think this time around, they will. I think now with social media, with being able to really document things as they happen, to expose things so quickly, that many more women will step forward.
Well,
both to run and simply to vote. There are so many women that do not vote.
Well, that certainly is a shame. My grandmother, who was orphaned at age of 2 and had come over from Europe, she was hesitant to the end of her days. She never voted. She didn't feel she was informed enough. And I tried to argue that if you look at some of the votes held in Congress, that's
not required. Exactly. No, but now I think, and I'm reading more and more. I have more faith in the high school students right now than some of the girls a little bit older. I see a lot of people in their teens very involved, very aware, writing amazing blogs, having a little more, they're less intimidated.
I think you're right. Well, Paige, thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate you spending some time with us, and best of luck. I look forward to your next essay. Please make sure you send it my way, okay?
Thank you, Richard. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Well, let's see. Ladies and gentlemen, let me please reintroduce Miss P.E. Nolan, also Tricia. And Tricia is a wonderful writer. She's an educator, an activist, and just recently appeared at KGB. Or is that coming up? I wasn't quite sure.
Actually, that's coming up.
Okay, in a humorous series called Drunken Careening Writers. Boy, if that isn't a title, I don't know what is.
Listen, it's a great series. It is Drunken Careening Writers is one of my favorite things in New York, and I'm also just been involved with a lot of gay rights activists, LGBT activists, and so a lot of the guys who are stand-up comedians on HBO that are also gay read there too, and so it's just always funny. And I've been ever since we arranged this chat tonight, I've been trying to think of, like, geez, how am I an activist? Because I don't really think of myself as an activist. As an educator, certainly, and I do write. But then when I say something like, "Oh yeah," the other side of silence is gay activism, and I don't really feel like I'm out in the streets that way, or stuffing envelopes or going to meetings and things like that. I just sort of run around and give my support where I can, as much as I can, and sometimes that just means sticking $20, throwing $20 at Tim DeChristopher, who's pretty much my favorite activist. And, that's what I do.
Well, you write some awfully funny stuff, and it's always pithy and to the point, if you ask me. What grade do you teach?
I work with 2-year-olds. I'm a preschool teacher.
Oh, how awesome!
Awesome. And I think that, really, in terms of my work, I mean, I like grown-ups. I have grown-ups for friends,
in
of
their,
course.
In their place.
But what I feel like I really get to do is go in at a early level, or very early, when a kid is 2 or 3, and point out to parents that they need to be reflecting on what they're doing. So that, for example, right after the Deepwater disaster in the Gulf, I was making a big deal about, we have to clean up our own mess. And if you're running around picking up after your kid all the time instead of holding your child accountable for his foolish, all kids make messes. They like to throw Cheerios on the floor and step on them, but they need to know how to sweep that up. Otherwise, your kid is going to grow up to be a BP executive, and is that what you wanted? And when you ask people to reflect on what the hell they're doing, and because they don't always. I mean, you just go on automatic. And I've got kids, I'm up to my ass in kids. And so anyway, that's what I think is really my main work I did just have to write a piece about the Tampax in Texas, because that was just about the dumbest thing I'd heard of in a long time. And I originally come from Texas, and so it was a great illustration to show all my friends that fix this and maybe I'll come back again. Otherwise, I'll be here in New York where it's safe, at least for the woman's right to choose. I have to say, listening to you and Paige talk that and what you see within your work for peace, of war everywhere, that reproductive rights are threatened because they need more soldiers. And the more women without the access to birth control, the more kids that are indentured servants with student loans, the more soldiers they have for an all-volunteer military. Because looking out at all those kids during Vietnam saying, hell no, we won't go, you got to remember Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld were standing right there looking at that. And those guys are still out there today. And making sure that we can feed an all-volunteer military. So we can go into Afghanistan and get the minerals in those hills. Nothing has changed. And
right,
I point that out to parents, too. It's like, keep your kids safe. And I get serious. But, that reproductive thing, it's important. When you consider that a white baby on the open adoption, on private adoption market is like $50,000 to $100,000 for a white baby, and Newt Gingrich was saying, oh, we need orphanages when they were in the primary so they can have workhouses for the brown ones, give me a break. I think the antebellum stuff is, alive and well.
I've been around for a few weeks now through this end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st, and I see these arguments about war and peace, and that there's all these really good reasons to go invade and go bomb and please arm somebody, and we'll train the next group of terrorists that'll later attack us. And it seems to me that the repetitive nature of this whole endeavor seems to be lost on most people. And I try whenever possible to remind people, read a little history, be exposed. And I really shudder to think how easy war is going to be when it's fought entirely by machines, by kids behind joysticks that think that this is just one more video game.
And that's what's happening. And, we all know it's true. The question is, how do we... and that's what you do, is give us a way so we can reach out across, reach out from thousands of miles to each other, hundreds of miles to each other, and say, hey, we're in this together, and there are people who think like you, and that's what I like about blogging and things like Roundtree 7 and Worldwide Hippies uniting, and here the blog talk unites people who may feel isolated in their own community. And because it's hard to talk to your neighbors about this kind of stuff often, but I do think we need to.
Our next guest is going to be a perfect exemplar of that. He's up in the panhandle of Florida, and we heard another horrible story last week from a good progressive up in the panhandle. I mean, I don't care whether you call it the antebellum South or the southern portion of Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia. But what it is it's this country, America. And if people aren't getting their rights, by God, Americans have to make sure that human rights aren't confined to a free speech zone.
Yeah, in a cage in a free speech. I mean, since when I was down at Occupy, because, I live in New York City, so I could, hang down at Zuccotti Park. And Reverend Billy was down there, and pointed out that we have not had a place to assemble. There's not been freedom of assembly since 9/11. And,
that's right.
It's just little by little it's gone. And, at the conventions where your free speech zone is a half a mile away or whatever it was. Give me a break. But that's how they like it. And I don't blame them. I'm thinking of when the Republicans had their convention here in the city and they all were on a cruise ship in the harbor because they wouldn't stay in a hotel with us around. So anyway, like those guys, geez Louise.
One of the other things I find amazing about Republicans is their takeaway from this last drubbing they got at the election time was that it wasn't that their message was bad. It was they weren't good at presenting it. So they keep banging on these really stupid agenda items, and you wonder, you know, who's writing their script? Is this some cartoonist? I mean, my God, confiscating tampons and maxi pads? This, what
yeah,
kind of
well,
democracy is
yeah.
that?
I mean, but you know, I mean, like I sort of have abandoned both of the major parties to go into smaller and start.
Oh, paying
you know,
attention, huh?
You know, well, you know, I'm like fully green these days because I don't believe in voting for people that I believe should be in jail. And so,
really trims your options, huh?
Yeah, it limits it, you know. And I mean, I think at the local level, there are plenty of good Democrats. Don't get me wrong. I think it's like once you get up into the national arena, however, the amount of money that's involved is just so great that, you know, Citizens United, we don't have to talk about that. But I forgot what I was saying anyway. Anyway, my mother and I were talking. Now, my mother is really an activist down in Texas, although she would say not. But she was just saying that, you know, they have opportunities all over Texas where people would vote Democrat, even with all the gerrymandering that Tom DeLay had done. But they keep picking goofy candidates. And so what are you going to do?
Yep, yep. Well, you know, I was wondering if you'd tell us a little bit about the story that you're going to read on the...
At KGB?
At KGB, yeah.
This is a story... I have to preface this by saying that I'm reading on one of the founders of the series. It's her birthday. And so I'm telling a story that she was involved in, which had to do with... the night my ex-husband finally left, I had filed for divorce 2 years previously, and there was some question about his sexuality, and I had been at a party a couple of weeks earlier where there was like a room full of gay porn stars and jello shots. And so I had invited the room full of gay porn stars over to finally settle once and for all some questions we had regarding my ex-husband, which is why I have to write under an assumed name, which is Pete Nolan, because my ex-husband was pissed because I was so tacky about the gay porn stars. And anyway, it was a silly little thing. Well, it wasn't silly. It was actually a major blowout. But anyhow, I'm telling the story about the night with the gay porn stars and that party and how the birth of P. E. Nolan, as it happens. You know, that was the day years ago. I guess it was like 2006. That P. E. Nolan had to come into being so that, you know, but it works out, too, because I think that if you're sort of living out loud on the Internet and talking about the things that I bring up that I think are PG-13 that people are, you know, would curl my mother's hair. It's nice to know they can't find you in the phone book.
Right. Hey, let me ask you this. When, you know, you're obviously an intelligent person, what was it in your life that threw that switch for you, that you had to be participating, you had to be part of the civil discourse, that you had to speak up and stand up?
Well, I think my parents really gave me that. I mean, I was like in fourth or fifth grade when Richard Nixon was elected. Maybe fourth grade, I think. And, you know, it was an intense time. And, you know, my parents had, my mother especially, had sort of thrown off the idea that she had to just be nice and hush and hooked up with a bunch of feminists in St. Louis, Missouri. And, you know, that's just how we grew up. And so... you know, like she wasn't out in the streets or doing anything like that either. She had to stay home and take care of us, but she was taking in foster kids. She was getting involved in peace vigils. You know, being involved means different things to different people. And I think so often you hear the term activist and think you have to be going places or out in the street when you know, maybe you can't walk anymore. I think that's like with a lot of us who are in that old hippie zone, you know, we're limping along here and in no condition to be chucking tear gas grenades back at cops, you know. And so there's just lots of ways to be involved. And so I think that whenever anybody can find a way to feel comfortable, you know, stand up and do it. And really, if that means just sending, you know, $20 to Planned Parenthood, you know, good job.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Of all the pressing issues, you know, we have progressive values under so many different kinds of attacks, whether on the environmental front or the free speech front, the civic rights front, whistleblowers, Monsanto and GM. I mean, there's so many different arenas. Where is your, if you were to say you had a focus, what's some of the most important two or three of those for you?
I feel the most affinity for environmental issues. You know, I still say Tim DeChristopher is my hero right now. No, I just really like what Tim does and the whole organization, Peaceful Uprising. I think that you see a lot of the same countercultural spirit in the environmental movement that we saw back in the 60s, just out there really on the front lines. And so, but I feel affinity towards the environment. And if I had to go with one, I would go with, you know, Move to Amend and getting the money out of politics.
Uh-huh.
You know, that I like that organization, but, you know, it's just so, I mean, like I said, I mean, it's really, I mean, just like the whole thing is so colossally fucked up, you know, that I mean, it's like, where are you going to start? And so one thing my mother told me back when I was freaking out about this in fifth grade about everything in the world is just there's so much to be done. You know, there's so much to be done. How can this possibly happen? Because, I mean, really, I mean, you can say all this kind of stuff, and then when you consider that there are girls down the block from, you know, in every city that are, you know, in the sex trade, you know, human trafficking, you know, there's just so much stuff going on. And you just have to trust that people are tending to, you know, I'm going to tend to what I tend to, you tend to what you tend to. We have to trust that there are enough people out there that care as much as we do about different stuff so that it'll all get tended to.
Tricia, thank you so much for joining us and sharing some of your thoughts. We occasionally have an artist show, and I'd like you to think about bringing a piece to that artist show next time we schedule one that you can read us some of your writing, okay?
I would love to. You know how to find me.
Okay. Thanks so much, Trish.
Thanks so
much. We'll talk to you soon,
bye-bye.
Okay? Bye-bye.
Yeah, you too. Bye.
Thanks. Okay, folks, next up, Mr. Frank Day, a Democrat from the Panhandle. Frank is Walton County DEC Chair. He's District 1 Director of Small County Coalition and also Congressional District 1 Chair. Frank, welcome, sir. Welcome. Frank, are you there? Okay, well, maybe not. Let's go ahead and play a little something till Frank comes back. He may have stepped away from the phone for a minute. I've got a really interesting little piece that was from the World Bank whistleblower. Frank, hopefully you're going to come back in just a minute. Meanwhile, I'm going to play this World Bank whistleblower piece. Seems that whistleblowers come in a couple different arenas.
Her name is Karen Hudes. She was senior counsel at the World Bank for 12 years before blowing the whistle. She's joining me now to talk about her experience and what it all means for the rest of us. I'm joined by Karen Hudes. Thank you so much for coming on, Karen.
Thanks for having me.
So could you briefly explain what the impetus was for you to speak out? What did you see?
I was a lawyer, and I saw securities fraud. I saw financial information that was not being disclosed to $180 billion worth of bondholders. It was my job to make sure that the financial statements were correct. So first, I reported it up the corporate ladder to the audit committee. When that didn't work, I went to the U.S. Treasury Department. And when that didn't work, I went to the U.S. Congress. Senator Lugar wrote three letters to the World Bank saying, don't fire this lady. and they promptly fired me. This means that the U.S. Congress does not have the information that it needs. So they stuck with the problem. After I was fired, three senators asked for a GAO inquiry into the corruption that I was reporting at the World Bank. Senators Lugar, Leahy, and Bob.
Frank, are you there?
Walk us through what exactly, you know,
Frank,
where was
the
money being laundered to
whom?
The money was going every which way because anybody that reported misconduct was fired. So in one case, the borrowers were being overcharged. In another case, I was reporting corruption in the Philippines, $900 million worth of money that should have gone to fight poverty in the Philippines. Instead, went to a corrupt man, Lucio Tan, who was in default on his loans. Philippine National Bank went into default. There was a run on the bank. Philippine National, the investment company tried to bail out the bank for $500 million. And then the board was lied to. And my story is about trying to uncover the cover-up. The cover-up went all the way to Congress, and then it went to 188 ministers of finance. So this is corruption in the entire world. And until it's set straight, what we're going to have is we're going to have a currency war.
So you think that this was just a microcosm of what's happening across the entire institution? You just saw one aspect of this kind of laundering.
It wasn't just me. There's a group of World Bank whistleblowers. There's one of us from the United Kingdom. There's one of us from Mexico. There's one of us from India. There's one of us from Ethiopia. And we're all reporting the
Frank, are you there?
Corruption from top to bottom of that institution.
Okay, no
going
Frank
every
yet.
Which way, but where it needs to go to fight poverty.
And so you said that you were kind of stifled. You went to the government and then you had a couple senators on your side, congresspeople. What of the corporate press? You said that you continuously tried to go to them with the story to cover it, and you were shunned as well.
Absolutely. And the reason why, I found out, it's because the corporate press is owned by one mega conglomerate. All of the financial institutions in the world, just about, are part of this scheme to rip off everybody, every single citizen on this planet. That's what I'm talking about. And it's not just my idea. There was a very accurate report on this from the Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich, Switzerland. Three mathematicians looked at accurate corporate data on 43,000 transnational companies, and they reported that through very clever interlocking corporate directors, these groups managed to grab 10 times the power than they otherwise had in their finances. So they own 40% of the assets of all of the companies traded on the capital markets of the world, and they own 60% of the earnings for every year. This means that the central banks for the world are issuing paper money with absolutely no accountability to the people who are using this money. And pretty soon, in a matter of weeks probably, the whole system is going to come to a screeching halt with something called gold backwardation.
Well, let's back up a little bit because, I mean, basically there's no oversight over these institutions. Aside from laundering money, plainly, they're also laundering money offshore, hidden in these bank accounts, offshore bank accounts. I want to talk about how much power the banking system really has over geopolitics. I mean, you just broke down that all of these people are kind of interlocking. Would you say that they control the government as well?
Absolutely. What I have documented is state capture. I tried to have information go to the voters before the presidential election because Robert Zoellick was Mitt Romney's National Security Transition Planning Chief. CBS wouldn't report it. If the voters don't know who they're voting for, I asked CBS to have a question on international corruption. Basically, the American public didn't need to know. So if the public doesn't know what's really going on, then you don't have a democracy, and that's what we're talking about.
Can you name any names of who you think are the real power players here? Because I know that, you know, if a little bit of digging can really reveal who these people are that are kind of pulling the strings here.
What you need to do is you need to look at the ownership of these corporations. They're the ones that we hear about all the time. Goldman Sachs.
Yeah.
You were talking about Bank of America. They are actually all one bank. That's what happened when we saw the LIBOR crisis. These institutions are one big conglomerate that think they control the world and they think they're above the law, and they're not. What about the, just the,
IMF and World Bank, kind of looking back since you served so long in this institution, what do you think about kind of what they present and sell themselves to the entire world? I mean, the whole structural adjustment policy, keeping the third world perpetually in debt, and even that's just an entire room to maintain their profit structure. I think these are institutions.
Mr. Day, welcome. Hello? Frank, is that you? Hello, Frank. 909-525-2223. Is that you? Oh, there we go. Okay. Hello, Frank.
Hey, Richard. How are you doing, brother?
There we go. There we go. A little technical snafu. Frank, you know, sir, it's a wonder. Glad you could make it. Frank is Walton County DEC Chair, District 1 Director of Small County Coalition, Congressional District 1 Chair. Frank, what's new up in North Florida, sir?
What's new up in North Florida? Oh, my goodness.
Or what's over and old and repeating?
Oh, we've always got the repeating thing, trying to beat back the red machine. But
so you got the
anyways,
Tea Partiers up there in addition to the Republicans, huh?
Yes, we are. Heavy, heavy Republican district up here. When I first moved into the Panhandle 27 years ago, it was in the high 80s and 90s percent Democrat. And, of course, most of these older folks, what haven't passed away by now, are they still quite a few of the old Democrats still around that had converted just out of convenience to be able to vote. But they're what you call a swing voter. Most of them will tell you they vote for the man, so we've got a
chance.
Well,
that's good.
Yeah.
Tell us, you've been a Democratic powerhouse up there in North Central Florida. What's your secret? How do you get people out for these heavily contested districts up there? What's your secret, buddy?
Well, here lately, the Republicans have been our biggest ally in doing that. Believe it or not, I told the former president of the South Walton County Tea Party Association that very thing here recently. I says, I said, you guys have been our best fundraising activity, our best get out the vote effort we've had in years. That coupled with our current governor is making our jobs. I told him making our jobs really easy.
I've said many times that people like Nixon and the Bushes made the job of organizing Democrats a whole lot easier.
Yeah, that's right. Here lately, though, we've been filling county commission rooms with disgruntled residents. Our Republican administration in Walton County has become the tax and spend liberals they've always called the Democrats. And really, it's phenomenal. They're trying to ram through a fire district tax, Walton County Fire District tax, through a special assessment onto the unincorporated areas of the counties. They'd coaxed them into changing over from volunteer fire districts a few years back, I think 97 or something like that it was, and set up a municipal service benefit unit for them, but with a $25 per household assessment is all they paid for about, what is it, 15 years, 16 years now. So now the residents of South Walton, they had done, and from the inception of that, had subsidized the north end of the county, all those unincorporated areas out of ad valorem taxes, with 93% of those taxes countywide coming from all of those residents that live south of Chattahatchee Bay, the very south end of the county. So South End has its own special taxing district. Years ago, we voted in our own special taxing district. So having done so, and now the county's using ad valorem taxes to subsidize the fire services for the north residents, it's created a double taxation issue with regard to the residents of the south end of the county now being singled out. Everybody else gets subsidies out of ad valorem to run their fire, and South Walton has to pay. So now they're looking at an assessment to raise the ad valorem fire district assessments on all the North County residents up from $25 to $95. And, you know, you have a lot of residents out in the outlying areas that have been used to only paying $25 and prior to that having paid literally nothing other than ad valorem taxes and operated the volunteer fire districts. So they're up in arms now. And I think the last Tuesday we had a special hearing on that, a workshop at the commission, and literally the house was full, overflowing out into the parking lot. And 40-odd people signed up to speak against it, so they got an earful. The commissioners got an earful last week. So that's they've already asked. They're looking for Democrats to run, is what it is. Now we've got Republican folks out in the country that used to be Democrats are now looking for Democrats to run against these people.
Amazing, amazing.
Yep.
You know, up there in the Panhandle, obviously you guys were the beneficiaries of BP's tender mercies there. Your time in that area before the big spill and then after the big spill, have you seen any differences, sir?
Yes, for the year during the spill, the 2010 tourist season was pretty much non-existent. Our county suffered from the ad valorem tax collection standpoint enormously. We're the only school district, though, in the Panhandle that didn't close any schools. So our school district had a substantial enough reserve. The county had enough reserve that we came through it pretty well. I got to say, BP did what they said. They stepped up and flooded the marketing and the following year after. And this year we're setting records again on tourism. So it's picking up tremendously. We still have oil product that washes up every time we have a major storm event. We'll still have oil product that will wash up that's buried in the sand right at the water's edge. And that's going to be for years to come. I mean, that's just the way that works. It washes ashore and then just sits there as the waves come in and lap it, just drills it down into the ground a foot and a half into the sand. And then when the big events come and scalp the sand off, there's leaves the oil on the surface.
Now,
it's eroded down, though, to really balls that can be easily picked up with gloved hands. It's not that big a deal. They just dispatch the BP contractors out to wherever the locations it's reported, and they pick it up, and off they're going again.
Well, Frank, we're almost out of time. What do Southern and Central Floridians need to know about the Panhandle, sir?
We're on the map with the wake-up call that we gave the Republican Tea Party candidate over in Pensacola with the House District 2 race. We pulled right at 42% of the vote in that race, close enough that it generated a need on their part, some of their supporters, I believe, though their chef says that the break-in at the supervisor of election in South Santa Rosa County was not politically motivated. I beg to differ on that. It was clearly politically motivated. When the break-in alarm sounded and the alarm company made the call in at around 2 in the morning, just after 2 o'clock in the morning, the video then shows the timeline documented with a timestamp on it. And about 2 hours, the guys came in, surveyed the place, left. 2 hours later, came back with hand trucks and made off with the two safes that had the documents, the voting machine, tabulator, thumb drive, uh-huh. And absentee ballots, as well as early voting ballots and I think 800 blank absentee ballots as well. So clearly a politically motivated theft and break-in, just based on the fact there was 2 hours between the actual emergency or the call-in and the actual sheriff deputies getting to the scene.
Well, thank you, sir, for that sad story of voting corruption and mishandling of votes. We're gonna delve into this story more. So, Frank, we're gonna have you back again soon. Thanks so much
okay.
for joining us,
right.
Ladies and gentlemen. Good night for PNN. I'm your host, Rick Spezak, news director, and I want to thank my associate producer, Ms. Renee Shacker, who had evidently some technical difficulties tonight. Good night,
okay,
and we'll
no
talk
problem.
To you next week.
Right. Shout out to all my
Want to change the world, there's nothing. Want to change the world, there's nothing to it, nothing to it. There is no life like the world. world of pure imagination. Living to-bop, you'll be free, free if you truly wish to be. If you truly wish to be. If you truly wish to be. If you truly wish to be.
Good night, ladies and gentlemen. We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.